Chapter 67. I have no other claim upon my means, and you are my adopted child. Only be a loving child to me in my age, and bear with my whims and fancies, and you will do more for an old woman whose prime of life was not so happy, or conciliating as it might have been, than ever that old woman did for you. Apostrophe, it was the first time I had heard my aunt refer to her past history. There was a magnanimity in her quiet way of doing so, and of dismissing it, which would have exalted her in my respect and affection, if anything could. All is agreed and understood between us now, Trot, apostrophe said my aunt, and we need talk of this no more. Give me a kiss, and we'll go to the Commons after breakfast tomorrow. Apostrophe, we had a long chat by the fire, before we went to bed. I slept in a room on the same floor with my aunts, and was a little disturbed in the course of the night by her knocking at my door as often as she was agitated by a distant sound of hackney coaches or market carts, and inquiring if I heard the engines. Apostrophe, apostrophe, but towards morning she slept better, and suffered me to do so too. At about midday, we set out for the office of Messrs. Spenlow and Jorkins, in Doctor's Commons. My aunt, who had this other general opinion in reference to London, that every man she saw was a pickpocket, gave me her purse to carry for her, which had 10 guineas in it and some silver. We made a pause at the toy shop in Fleet Street, to see the Giants of St. Dunstan strike upon the bells we had timed our going, so as to catch them at it, at 12 o'clock, and then went on towards Ludgate Hill, and St. Paul's Churchyard. We were crossing to the former place, when I found that my aunt greatly accelerated her speed, and looked frightened. I observed, at the same time, that a lowering ill-dressed man who had stopped and stared at us in passing, a little before, was coming so close after us, as to brush against her. Trot! My dear Trot! Apostrophe cried my aunt, in a terrified whisper, and pressing my arm. I don't know what I am to do. Apostrophe, don't be alarmed, apostrophe said one. There's nothing to be afraid of. Step into a shop, and I'll soon get rid of this fellow. Apostrophe, no, no, child. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she returned. Don't speak to him for the world. I entreat, I order you. Apostrophe, apostrophe, good heaven, aunt. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said one. He is nothing but a sturdy beggar. Apostrophe, you don't know what he is. Apostrophe, apostrophe, replied my aunt. You don't know who he is. You don't know what you say. Apostrophe, we had stopped in an empty doorway, while this was passing, and he had stopped too. Don't look at him. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said my aunt, as I turned my head indignantly, but get me a coach, my dear, and wait for me in St. Paul's Churchyard. Apostrophe, wait for you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I replied. Yes, apostrophe, rejoined my aunt. I must go alone. I must go with him. Apostrophe, with him, aunt? This man? Apostrophe, I am in my senses, apostrophe, she replied, and I tell you I must. Get me coach. Apostrophe, apostrophe, however much astonished I might be, I was sensible that I had no right to refuse compliance with such a peremptory command. I hurried away a few paces, and called a hackney chariot which was passing empty. Almost before I could let down the steps, my aunt sprang in, I don't know how, and the man followed. She waved her hand to me to go away, so earnestly, that, all confounded as I was, I turned from them at once. In doing so, I heard her say to the coachman, drive anywhere. Drive straight on. Apostrophe, and presently the chariot passed me, going up the hill. What Mr. Dick had told me, and what I had supposed to be a delusion of his, now came into my mind. I could not doubt that this person was the person of whom he had made such mysterious mention, though what the nature of his hold upon my aunt could possibly be, I was quite unable to imagine. After half an hour's cooling in the churchyard, I saw the chariot coming back. The driver stopped beside me, and my aunt was sitting in it alone. She had not yet sufficiently recovered from her agitation to be quite prepared for the visit we had to make. She desired me to get into the chariot and to tell the coachman to drive slowly up and down a little while. She said no more, except, "My dear child, never ask me what it was, and don't refer to it," apostrophe until she had perfectly regained her composure, when she told me she was quite herself now, and we might get out. On her giving me her purse to pay the driver, I found that all the guineas were gone, and only the loose silver remained. Doctor's Commons was approached by a little low archway. Before we had taken many paces down the street beyond it, the noise of the city seemed to melt, as if by magic, into a softened distance. A few dull courts and narrow ways brought us to the sky-lighted offices of Spenlow and Jorkins, in the vestibule of which temple, accessible to pilgrims without the ceremony of knocking, three or four clerks were at work as copyists. One of these, a little dry man, sitting by himself, who wore a stiff brown wig that looked as if it were made of gingerbread, rose to receive my aunt and show us into Mr. Spenlow's room. Apostrophe Mr. Spenlow's in court, ma'am, apostrophe said the dry man. It's an Arch's day, but it's close by, and I'll send for him directly. Apostrophe, as we were left to look about us, while Mr. Spenlow was fetched, I availed myself of the opportunity. The furniture of the room was old-fashioned and moldy, and the green baize on the top of the writing table had lost all its color, and was as withered and pale as an old pauper. There were a great many bundles of papers on it, some endorsed as allegations, and some, to my surprise, as libels, and some as being in the consistory court, and some in the arches court, and some in the prerogative court, and some in the admiralty court, and some in the delegates court, giving me occasion to wonder much how many courts there might be in the gross, and how long it would take to understand them all. Besides these, there were sundry immense manuscript books of evidence taken on affidavit, strongly bound, and tied together in massive sets, a set to each cause, as if every cause were a history in 10 or 20 volumes. All this looked tolerably expensive, I thought, and gave me an agreeable notion of a proctor's business. I was casting my eyes with increasing complacency over these and many similar objects, when hasty footsteps were heard in the room outside, and Mr. Spenlow, in a black gown trimmed with white fur, came hurrying in, taking off his hat as he came. He was a little light-haired gentleman, with undeniable boots, and the stiffest of white cravats and shirt collars. He was buttoned up, mighty trim and tight, and must have taken a great deal of pains with his whiskers, which were accurately curled. His gold watch chain was so massive that a fancy came across me that he ought to have a sinewy golden arm to draw it out with, like those which are put up over the gold beaters' shops. He was got up with such care, and was so stiff, that he could hardly bend himself. Being obliged, when he glanced at some papers on his desk, after sitting down in his chair, to move his whole body, from the bottom of his spine, like Punch. I had previously been presented by my aunt, and had been courteously received. He now said, "And so, Mr. Copperfield, you think of entering into our profession?" I casually mentioned to Miss Trotwood, when I had the pleasure of an interview with her the other day, apostrophe with another inclination of his body Punch again, that there was a vacancy here. Miss Trotwood was good enough to mention that she had a nephew who was her peculiar care, and for whom she was seeking to provide genteelly in life. That nephew, I believe, I have now the pleasure of Punch again. I bowed my acknowledgments, and said, "My aunt had mentioned to me that there was that opening, and that I believed I should like it very much. That I was strongly inclined to like it, and had taken immediately to the proposal. That I could not absolutely pledge myself to like it until I knew something more about it. That although it was little else than a matter of form, I presumed I should have an opportunity of trying how I liked it before I bound myself to it irrevocably." Oh, surely. Surely. apostrophe said Mr. Spenlow. We always, in this house, propose a month and initiatory month. I should be happy, myself, to propose 2 months, three an indefinite period, in fact, but I have a partner, Mr. Jorkins. Apostrophe, and the premium, sir, apostrophe I returned, is £1,000? Apostrophe, and the premium, stamp included, is £1,000, apostrophe said Mr. Spenlow. As I have mentioned to Miss Trotwood, I am actuated by no mercenary considerations. Few men are less so, I believe, but Mr. Jorkins has his opinions on these subjects, and I am bound to respect Mr. Jorkins' opinions. Mr. Jorkins thinks £1,000 too little, in short. Apostrophe, I suppose, sir, apostrophe said I, still desiring to spare my aunt, that it is not the custom here, if an articled clerk were particularly useful, and made himself a perfect master of his profession I could not help blushing, this looked so like praising myself I suppose it is not the custom, in the later years of his time, to allow him any apostrophe. Mr. Spenlow, by a great effort, just lifted his head far enough out of his cravat to shake it, and answered, anticipating the word salary. No. I will not say what consideration I might give to that point myself, Mr. Copperfield, if I were unfettered. Mr. Jorkins is immovable. Apostrophe, I was quite dismayed by the idea of this terrible Jorkins. But I found out afterwards that he was a mild man of a heavy temperament, whose place in the business was to keep himself in the background, and be constantly exhibited by name as the most obdurate and ruthless of men. If a clerk wanted his salary raised, Mr. Jorkins wouldn't listen to such a proposition. If a client were slow to settle his bill of costs, Mr. Jorkins was resolved to have it paid, and however painful these things might be and always were to the feelings of Mr. Spenlow, Mr. Jorkins would have his bond. The heart and hand of the good angel Spenlow would have been always open, but for the restraining demon Jorkins. As I have grown older, I think I have had experience of some other houses doing business on the principle of Spenlow and Jorkins. It was settled that I should begin my month's probation as soon as I pleased, and that my aunt need neither remain in town nor return at its expiration, as the articles of agreement, of which I was to be the subject, could easily be sent to her at home for her signature. When we had got so far, Mr. Spenlow offered to take me into court then and there, and show me what sort of place it was. As I was willing enough to know, we went out with this object, leaving my aunt behind, who would trust herself, she said, in no such place, and who, I think, regarded all courts of law as a sort of powder mills that might blow up at any time. Mr. Spenlow conducted me through a paved courtyard formed of grave brick houses, which I inferred, from the doctor's names upon the doors, to be the official abiding places of the learned advocates, of whom Steerforth had told me, and into a large dull room, not unlike a chapel to my thinking, on the left hand. The upper part of this room was fenced off from the rest, and there, on the two sides of a raised platform of the horseshoe form, sitting on easy old-fashioned dining room chairs, were sundry gentlemen in red gowns and gray wigs, whom I found to be the doctors aforesaid. Blinking over a little desk like a pulpit desk, in the curve of the horseshoe, was an old gentleman, whom, if I had seen him in an aviary, I should certainly have taken for an owl, but who, I learned, was the presiding judge. In the space within the horseshoe, lower than these, that is to say, on about the level of the floor, were sundry other gentlemen, of Mr. Spenlow's rank, and dressed like him in black gowns with white fur upon them, sitting at a long green table. Their cravats were in general stiff, I thought, and their looks haughty, but in this last respect I presently conceived I had done them an injustice. For when two or three of them had to rise and answer a question of the presiding dignitary, I never saw anything more sheepish. The public, represented by a boy with a comforter and a shabby genteel man secretly eating crumbs out of his coat pockets, was warming itself at a stove in the center of the court. The languid stillness of the place was only broken by the chirping of this fire, and by the voice of one of the doctors, who was wandering slowly through a perfect library of evidence, and stopping to put up, from time to time, at little roadside inns of argument on the journey. Altogether, I have never, on any occasion, made one at such a cozy, dozy, old-fashioned, time-forgotten, sleepy-headed little family party in all my life, and I felt it would be quite a soothing opiate to belong to it in any character except perhaps as a suitor. Very well satisfied with the dreamy nature of this retreat, I informed Mr. Spenlow that I had seen enough for that time, and we rejoined my aunt, in company with whom I presently departed from the Commons, feeling very young when I went out of Spenlow and Jorkins, on account of the clerks poking one another with their pens to point me out. We arrived at Lincoln's Inn Fields without any new adventures, except encountering an unlucky donkey in a costermonger's cart, who suggested painful associations to my aunt. We had another long talk about my plans, when we were safely housed, and as I knew she was anxious to get home, and, between fire, food, and pickpockets, could never be considered at her ease for half an hour in London, I urged her not to be uncomfortable on my account, but to leave me to take care of myself. I have not been here a week tomorrow, without considering that too, my dear, apostrophe she returned. There is a furnished little set of chambers, to be let in the Adelphi, Trot, which ought to suit you to a marvel. Apostrophe, with this brief introduction, she produced from her pocket an advertisement, carefully cut out of a newspaper, setting forth that in Buckingham Street in the Adelphi there was to be let furnished, with a view of the river, a singularly desirable and compact set of chambers, forming a genteel residence for a young gentleman, a member of one of the inns of court, or otherwise, with immediate possession. Terms moderate, and could be taken for a month only, if required. Why, this is the very thing, and apostrophe apostrophe said I, flushed with the possible dignity of living in chambers. Then come, apostrophe replied my aunt, immediately resuming the bonnet she had a minute before laid aside. We'll go and look at 'em. Apostrophe, away we went. The advertisement directed us to apply to Mrs. Krupp on the premises, and we rung the area bell, which we supposed to communicate with Mrs. Krupp. It was not until we had rung three or four times that we could prevail on Mrs. Krupp to communicate with us, but at last she appeared, being a stout lady with a flounce of flannel petticoat below a nankeen gown. Let us see these chambers of yours, if you please, ma'am, apostrophe said my aunt. For this gentleman? Apostrophe apostrophe said Mrs. Krupp, feeling in her pocket for her keys. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.